This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The teams of the Atlantic Coast Conference have been soaking up plenty of national press this year, and it's still preseason. Last month, the UNC Tar Heels played Michigan State on the deck of an aircraft carrier with President Obama in the crowd. A few days later, the Duke Blue Devils gave Coach Mike Krzyzewski his 903rd victory, making him the winningest coach in NCAA history. And to think, when the ACC emerged more than 50 years ago, basketball was an afterthought. In his new book, ACC Basketball, historian and author J. Samuel Walker traces the evolution of the conference and the rise of its basketball tradition in its first 20 years. And he joins us now from a studio in Washington, D.C. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Frank. It's nice to be here.
Good to have you. We're taking questions this hour as well about the ACC basketball and its beginnings and where it's gone since. Give us a call at 877-962-9862 or send us an email at sot@wunc.org if you want to talk to Sam Walker about his book, ACC Basketball. Sam, why'd you focus on the first two decades in this book?
For a couple reasons. One was that I started graduate school at the University of Maryland in 1969 and immediately became a fanatic fan of the ACC and at that time of Maryland. But I didn't know anything about the early years of the ACC. And so when I got close to retirement, I thought, well, it might be fun to do a book on the period of ACC history about which I knew virtually nothing. And I had heard the names of legendary coaches and players, but I really didn't know much about them. So writing this book for me was really a voyage of discovery, wonderful discovery about the early history of the ACC.
ACC gets started in 1953. Why? What was the genesis of that division or that conference?
The ACC was formed by seven schools that broke away from the Southern Conference. The Southern Conference had 17 teams. It was an unwieldy arrangement, in some ways not a good arrangement at all, but the event that really pushed hard for the founding of a new conference was a football scandal at the College of William & Mary, a member of the Southern Conference, and the football coaches in the athletic department at William & Mary had violated academic standards and academic integrity, and this was a really big issue, and it was certainly a big issue in the Southern Conference. So what happened was that you had two factions who wanted to break away from the Southern Conference for quite different reasons. One was a group of university presidents at North Carolina, NC State, Wake Forest, and Duke, who thought that a smaller conference would be a good way to establish a proper balance between academic standards and athletic objectives, and they thought they could do it more easily and better with a smaller conference. Another faction was offended by the fact that after the scandal at William & Mary, the Southern Conference banned participation by conference schools in bowl games. And so there was a group of presidents of Southern Conference schools who wanted to break away from the Southern Conference so that their teams could once again go to bowl games. So for quite different reasons, you had two factions whose interests merged, and the result was the forming of the ACC in 1953.
Let's talk about academic excellence for a moment. Those presidents that thought that there had to be a way to improve standards and still play a decent game. This leads to something called the 800 rule in the ACC. Tell us about it.
The 800 rule was a rule that was originally passed in 1960, and the standard at that point was 750. It was raised to 800 in 1964. The 800 rule said that originally said that anyone who wanted to attend an ACC school on a basketball or football scholarship had to score at least 800 on college boards. The ACC was the first conference to have such a rule. And it was a reflection of the goals that were prevalent among ACC schools when it was founded in 1953, that they wanted to strike the proper balance between athletic and academic ambitions, and this was an outgrowth of that objective.
And this rule caused quite a bit of strife right from the start within the conference in the early years.
It caused a lot of strife. And it gets very complicated. But by the late 1960s, The University of South Carolina, which at that time was a member of the ACC, and Clemson were protesting against the 800 rule because they claimed, with some justification, that it made it hard for them to compete with schools outside of the ACC, especially in the Southeastern Conference, because other schools didn't have a standard as strict as that of the ACC. And again, the issue was football. And the problem that officials of South Carolina and Clemson complained about was that they had to play against players from other schools who didn't have to meet an 800 standard, and that really hurt their chances in football. So it was that issue that caused South Carolina to leave the conference in 1971. Clemson had a much better sense of the advantages of staying in the ACC. And the ACC rule was then struck down by the courts in 1972, and that was the end of it.
Talking to Sam Walker about his book, ACC Basketball, looks at the first 20 years of the Atlantic Coast Conference. 800 rule had another effect, which I found interesting and learned in your book. It kept Pete Maravich from getting a scholarship to NC State.
Yeah, that was one of those things I found out in the course of my research. Pete's dad, Press Maravich, was a coach at NC State. He was a wonderful coach, and he planned to have Pete play for him and star for him at NC State, but Pete could not make the 800 score on the college board, so both Press and Pete wound up going to LSU instead.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to talk about ACC basketball with author Sam Walker, who's on the show today talking about his new book. There was also some support for something called the Gooch Report, which I guess preceded the ACC, but that recommended an end to all athletic scholarships. Is that right?
Well, the Gooch Report was a faculty report. Robert Gooch was a faculty member at the University of Virginia and had been a star football player. But there were a fair number of members of the faculty at Virginia, which had a good football team at that point, a pretty good basketball team. The Gooch Report was in 1951, but they were concerned about too much emphasis on sports. And what the Gooch Report recommended was that Virginia give no athletic scholarships, and that they pretty much play down their interest in athletics. So the Gooch Report was not formally adopted, but it was kind of an informal standard that was followed at Virginia until at least the 1960s, and one result was that Virginia was not very good in either football or basketball throughout the 1950s and most of the 1960s.
Now, you begin your book by comparing two games between the University of Maryland and South Carolina, the first in 53 when the conference got started and the second in 1971. Why was that contrast so compelling for you?
The reason was I thought it was a good bookend. The game in 1953, which was the first ACC basketball game ever played, December of 1953 between Maryland and South Carolina in Columbia. And it was kind of a ho-hum game. Maryland had a pretty good team. South Carolina didn't have a great team. There were about 3,000 people there. There was very little media coverage after the game. You had to look hard in the Washington, D.C. and Baltimore papers even to find an account of the game. The state, the paper in Columbia, gave the game a little more attention, but the headlines at that time were on baseball, even though it was long after baseball season, and other sports, and certainly not on the fact that this was the first game in the ACC, a brand new conference. By 1971, things had changed dramatically when South Carolina came to Maryland to play at Cole Fieldhouse. January of 1971, the game was covered by 48 reporters. It was broadcast on radio, of course, on live television. There were 14,300 and some impassioned fans at that game, and the atmosphere was just absolutely electric. So the difference between the ho-hum game of 1953, the exciting matchup of 1971, I thought was a good way to show how ACC basketball had changed dramatically in that time period.
And it has a lot to do with the fact that in 53, really college sports meant college football, right? I mean, it wasn't about basketball.
Yes, basketball was starting to gain popularity, but even in 1952 in Kansas City, and Kansas was in the NCAA finals that year, and loss, but the game was shown on television, but it was shown as a delayed broadcast after a boxing match.
Wow.
So college basketball has come a long way since the early 1950s in terms of interest, in terms of everything. It's striking when you look back.
It is, and you write in your book that one of the most important, in fact, the most important reason for the success of the ACC was the brilliance of its coaches. Why?
Yes, that's great coaches, and they attracted great players. But the ACC, in its first 20 years, had a whole lineup of just brilliant coaches who built excellent programs, were just excellent coaches, and they recruited excellent players, and they built a lot of very intense rivalries. And it's those coaches and the players who played for them and the rivalries that I think makes the ACC so so special and so different.
Colorful coaches like Bones McKinney at Wake Forest.
Bones McKinney, I think, is, in my view, is the most colorful character in the history of the ACC, and that's saying a lot.
Bones, right, because Lefty Grizzell was a coach in the ACC.
Well, yeah, and there were some other brilliant and and colorful coaches. Bones just stands head and shoulders because he was such a one. He was a brilliant coach. But he was also hilarious, and he had a wonderful sense of humor. And anyone, and I never had the honor of meeting him, but people who I've talked to who did know him say he was just extremely entertaining, extremely bright, and just a wonderful guy to be around. And I tell a few stories about some of his antics as coach, and so that's why I say he was in a class by himself in a very among some very tough competition for. Colorful characters.
I want to get you to tell at least one of those stories, particularly the one that that would be. It's important to know that he's a Baptist preacher. You can tell us that story.
Well, yeah, Bones was a wonderful player. He played at Durham High School, and then he played a year at NC State, and then he joined the Army, and then came back, played a year at Carolina, and then he was a wonderful player. And then he went and played in the pros for a while. After he was done playing basketball in the NBA, he went to seminary at Wake Forest, and he was hired as an assistant coach at Wake Forest for the not too princely salary of $750. And by that time, Bones had a family, and he was hoping that you know, when he was offered a job as assistant coach, that it would help to pay his bills. And he had a paper route at that time because he needed the money, and he was hoping that once he signed on as assistant coach, that he could give up the paper route. But he couldn't, at least for the first year, because his salary was $750.
Energetic guy, emotional guy on the sidelines, a Baptist preacher, and at one point he's cussing up and down the court, and a ref turns around and says, "I thought you were a preacher." And Bone says, "Yeah, I thought you were a ref."
Yeah, exactly.
Great story and great guy. Apparently, he was a guy that you couldn't keep down. Novelist Pat Conroy got a story about him as well, who was a player.
Pat Conroy played at the Citadel, and the Citadel was not a great basketball school, but they played ACC schools. And he tells wonderful stories about playing at Clemson, and Clemson was just a terrible place to play for opposing teams. The fans were right down on the court, literally right on the court. And they turned out Clemson wasn't very good. Clemson went 1-36 in his first three or four seasons in the ACC. But the men, and it was all men at that time, turned out to harass their opponents. And Pat Conroy tells a story of throwing the ball in, and he was pinched in the rear end at least twice, and also burned with cigarettes, because at that point you could smoke in arenas. So he said that Clemson was just the worst possible place that he ever played. And again, it was a lot of competition.
But pinched in the butt, burned with cigarettes, told the ref, and the ref just shrugged?
He just shrugged, yeah. He said, "Well, you playing at Clemson." I mean, he's indicated, "Well, you playing at Clemson, that's the way it goes." So
877-962-9862. Give us a call if you want to talk to Sam Walker, who's just written a book, ACC Basketball, covers the first 20 years of the conference's birth and rise to fame as a basketball conference. You say that Everett Case was the man who made ACC Basketball, NC State coach. Tell us about him.
Yes, Everett Case was hired at NC State in 1946, and he was hired. He had no experience as a college coach at that time. He had coached high school in Indiana, been extremely successful. And NC State decided that they wanted to upgrade their basketball program because they couldn't afford to upgrade their football program. And so they looked for the best coach they could find, and the coach that was recommended to them was Everett Case. Case came to State in 1946, immediately recruited a lot of great players from Indiana, where he came from, and immediately built NC State into the team to beat in the Southern Conference. NC State from 1946 until the founding of the ACC dominated the Southern Conference, and they dominated their most intense rivals, which were the members of what was then called the Big Four, which were State, Carolina, Duke, and Wake Forest. And so the other members of the Big Four, since Case was so successful, had to play catch up. Duke and Wake Forest did what they could to compete with State. North Carolina was especially offended by the fact that they were dominated by NC State, lost 15 games in a row to NC State in the late 40s and early 50s. And as a result, they expressly went out to find a coach who could build North Carolina's teams to a point where they could compete with Case's teams. And that's when they hired Frank McGuire in 1952.
And what was that relationship like, the relationship between Case and McGuire?
Well, it was tense. They often claimed away from the court that they were really good friends and that they simply carried on this rivalry to stir fan interest. I don't find that especially credible. There was lots of fan interest without them claiming that they were friends. They in fact didn't get along very well. They were different kinds of people. They were intense competitors, and McGuire quickly built teams at North Carolina that did compete, and in fact, within a short time, exceeded those of NC State. So there was an intense rivalry. There was a fair amount of ill will.
And the fact that how much did the fact that McGuire was a New Yorker and just sort of felt other down here, how much did that play into?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. When I talked to Pete Brennan, who was a wonderful player, as you know, from North Carolina, played on the national championship in 1957, was player of the year in the ACC in 1958, and Pete made a very interesting comparison. He said that that Case was like a small town mayor from Indiana, whereas McGuire was a big city boy from New York City, and he said that explained a lot of their dislike, or at least not getting along, their rivalry. And I thought that was a very insightful
rivalries,
way to characterize the two coaches.
And rivalries, you say, was a very important part of developing basketball and the ACC. This is something they did extremely well.
Yeah, the ACC, when the ACC was founded, the Big Four teams were all pretty good. State was dominant, but the other Big Four teams were pretty good. Maryland in the 50s was pretty good, and the other three schools, Clemson, South Carolina, and Virginia, were not good at all. And it stayed that way until the mid to late 1960s, and Maryland went downhill in the 60s as well. So by the mid-60s, you had four teams that were very good. They had their ups and downs, but they were generally very good, and four teams that were very poor. But in the mid-1960s, the four have-nots really took steps to upgrade their programs to become competitive with the strongest teams in the conference. So what happened by the late 1960s, early 1970s was exactly that. You had eight teams that were good. You had eight teams that were competitive. You had eight teams, any one of which was capable of beating any other team on any given night. And this, I think, is what made the ACC what it became, an extremely well-balanced, extremely strong from top to bottom. And that, of course, intensified rivalry, stirred fan interest, and made the ACC tournament, which Virginia coach Bill Gibson once called the greatest basketball show in the country, what it was.
And that tournament probably explains the NCAA tournament's success today.
To a large extent, and it's easy to lose sight of the fact of what a big thing the ACC tournament was in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, because only the team that won a tournament could go to the NCAA. So the pressures were enormous, the tensions were high, And the basketball was exciting. So the ACC tournament was just a great show.
Talking with Sam Walker today. We're going to take a little break right here, Sam, and come back.
Okay.
Sam Walker, author of ACC Basketball, talking with him about his book, The First 20 Years of the Conference. Our conversation continues with your phone calls at 877-962-9862 on the State of Things. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, looking back at the history of ACC basketball, my guest is Sam Walker. His new book is called ACC Basketball, the story of rivalries, traditions, and scandals in the first two decades of the Atlantic Coast Conference. We're taking your phone calls and emails, 877-962-9862 on the phone, sot@wunc.org. So, Sam, you described pretty well the arms race that created rivalries and interest in ACC basketball, but does that by itself explain how it, in a sense, displaced football or at least came to rival football in attention over those two decades?
Well, football wasn't very good in the ACC, and I don't talk a lot about football, but when you talk about college sports, you have to talk about football first, and ACC football struggled, and that was one reason why the controversy over the 800 rule was so much of an issue, because basketball in the ACC claimed more interest, claimed more success than football did. So that might have something to do with the extraordinary interest in ACC basketball in ACC territory.
And, of course, that 800 rule was groundbreaking, but then it was struck down by the Supreme Court, right?
Not by the Supreme Court, by a federal district court mm-hmm. judge who said it violated the 14th Amendment. The ACC thought about appealing, but was told it had no chance to win. So that was the end of the 800 rule, and I say in my book that I think that was unfortunate. What the 800 rule did, even though the threshold was quite low, I mean, 800 was not a great combined score, although in the 50s and 60s it was not that much different than the admission standards for all students at most schools in the ACC. And what the ACC rule did was to provide some assurance that students who accepted athletic scholarships would have a reasonable chance of succeeding academically and gaining their college degrees.
Let's go to the phones now. Dan is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Dan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm from North Carolina. I'm 60. And when that rule came about, 800 rule, I'm questioning it, because, I mean, like I say, I was told this by some folks that it has something to do with the integration of college sports coming up, or some of the places we're getting, like African-American people playing for them, and that was one way to block them from being mm-hmm. here, thinking that they could not pass the exam and stuff like that.
Sam?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there have been charges that the ACC passed the 800 rule in order to keep blacks from playing football and basketball. I found no evidence of that whatsoever. The 750 rule was passed in 1960, and it was not really a big issue yet. And there's no evidence in the minutes of meetings. The 800 rule did keep a lot of good players, including black players, from playing in the ACC. And we've talked some about Pete Maravich. It certainly kept some good black players from enrolling at ACC schools. But I certainly have found no evidence that was the reason for it, and that it was imposed with the idea of keeping blacks from playing in the ACC. The first black player in the ACC was Billy Jones, who played at Maryland, entered his first game in December of 1965.
And he had a tough – thank you for your call, Dan. He had a tough time of it, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a tough time. He took some abuse. He took some harassment from fans. And he didn't expect to be the only black player in the ACC when he enrolled at Maryland. It turned out that way. So it was not exactly what he expected, and he put up with a lot. But Billy is the kind of guy who could take it, and he did. And I think he's to be greatly admired for being a pioneer in ACC basketball.
When did schools in North Carolina desegregate their basketball teams?
Well, shortly after Billy arrived. Once Billy Jones played his first game, then the trend was clear. Maryland had a second black player the following year. Duke had a black player, C.D. Claiborne, the following year after Billy, 1966. North Carolina had Charles Scott, and Wake Forest had Norwood Todman the following season, 1967, talking about the varsities now. And it was not until 1971, though, that every school in the ACC had at least one black player on their roster. So it was a gradual progress.
You know, I think one of the most interesting things, one of the most surprising things that I read in your book was about Vic Bubas, coach, head basketball coach at Duke. Surprising only because I didn't realize Duke had another basketball coach. I thought Mike Krzyzewski was the only coach they ever had, who, by the way, I think I said he was the winningest coach in the NCAA. In fact, NCAA Division I men's basketball winningest coach with 903 victories, just to make that very clear. But Vic Bubas did coach at Duke and played an important part in the rise of the ACC, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Bubas was an excellent coach. He was an excellent recruiter. And he had been an assistant to Everett Case at NC State, and part of the reason that NC State got all the good players it did under Everett Case was that Bubas was such a great recruiter. He was hired as head coach in 1959 at Duke, and he quickly made Duke into a powerhouse. Duke in the 1950s was good, but not quite at the level of North Carolina and NC State. After Bubas arrived in 1959, Duke became very, very good very, very quickly. And in fact, Duke was the dominant team between 1960 and 1966 or 67 or so. That was also a time, the first 2 years in that period, Wake Forest was also very, very good.
877-962-9862. If you want to join the conversation with Sam Walker, his new book, ACC Basketball, the story of rivalries, traditions, and scandals in the first two decades of the Atlantic Coast Conference. The struggle to raise academic standards was one, the struggle to integrate another as the ACC grew and developed over those years. Segregation, of course, has touched every aspect of life and included seating arrangements and sporting events like the Dixie Classic. What was that event and how did its gradual integration help fight segregation all throughout the South?
And I'm not sure if it did that or not, but the Dixie Classic was a wonderful holiday tournament that was started at NC State by Everett Case at the suggestion of Dick Herbert, who was the primary sports columnist for the Raleigh News and Observer. Reynolds Coliseum at that time was brand new, and so North Carolina State started the Dixie Classic, in which the other members of the Big Four were invited, along with four other teams from who were powerful teams across the country. And what the Dixie Classic provided was great basketball for 3 days between Christmas and New Year's with the Big Four, and those rivalries were always intense. And also with top teams from across the country. So it was a great show. Reynolds Coliseum was always packed with fans, and people now compare it with the excitement that the NCAA tournament causes now across the country. So the Dixie Classic was huge, and it was just a great show, a great attraction. But it also raised some questions, and one question was, well, what happens if we invite teams to play in a Dixie Classic who have blacks on their team? And what State did was to find, and blacks, of course, couldn't stay in Sir Walter Raleigh or other downtown Raleigh hotels. And so State provided what apparently was not a luxurious former dormitory near campus in which teams when integrated teams played in the Dixie Classic. Mm. There are also questions about how do you seat fans, because fans, of course, could not seat, black and white fans were not allowed to seat, to be seated in the same sections or side by side. But this caused a bit of a problem, and when I wrote this or when I found out about this, you know, there are all kinds of racial issues beyond integration, which is the biggest issue, but race was always a delicate issue. So for the Dixie Classic, there was one section of Reynolds Coliseum that was reserved for black fans, and if they bought tickets, their seats were in that section. The issue came up when if blacks did not, if black fans did not buy all those seats, Then NC State went ahead and sold the unpurchased seats to white fans, and this caused de facto integration. And this caused at least some concern among fans and among citizens of North Carolina who wrote letters to the chancellor at NC State, whose name was Carrie Bostian, and said, "What is this? You know, you are integrating Reynolds Coliseum." And they were not at all happy about it. And Bostian's answer was kind of like, "Well, that's the way it goes. Sometimes we have to make compromises and go away," kind of thing. But the fact that it was an issue at all, yeah, I found very interesting.
Well, that Dixie Classic eventually was canceled by UNC President Bill Friday, right?
Yes, it was, and the Dixie Classic was canceled as a result of a point-shaving scandal, which became public in 1961, and there were four NC State players and one UNC players who were involved in conspiring with gamblers to shave points in basketball games, and this was a matter of great concern, of course. And as a result of the revelations about point shaving, President Friday, who was the president of what was then called the Consolidated University, along with the chancellors at North Carolina, William Aycock, and the chancellor at NC State, John Caldwell, agreed that there was too much emphasis on sports, too much emphasis on winning, and that the Dixie Classic was one prominent example of this. And so they agreed, and President Friday made the announcement that the Dixie Classic was canceled.
Of course, now the ACC was born in part out of concern for scandals in the larger league that they grew from. How widespread, though, was corruption and scandal in the first two decades of the ACC?
Well, the point-shaving scandal was the worst by far. I mean, there were lots of problems within the ACC with recruiting violations and other violations of NCAA rules. NC State in 1956 was placed on probation for 4 years because of recruiting violations by Everett Case, and I was astonished by that, 4 years. And it applied not only to basketball but to every sport in the school. So the football team in 1957 or 58 couldn't go to the Orange Bowl because of the basketball probation at NC State. And every school in the period I covered between 1953 and 1972 was guilty of infractions of various magnitude. Every school except Wake Forest and Virginia were either penalized or reprimanded by the NCAA in that period.
1972, when your book ends at that year, and that's about the time your brother, Wally Walker, started playing in the ACC at the University of Virginia. Tell us about that.
Go ahead. And that was one reason that I ended the book in 1972. I was afraid I would lose my claims to scholarly objectivity once Wally enrolled in the ACC. I'm hedging on it now because I am thinking about doing a sequel that would cover the next 20 years or so. But that's a different story.
He was quite a player for not a very good team.
He was a very good player, and they struggled when he played, but it had a happy ending because his senior year, Virginia won the ACC tournament, which was held in Landover, Maryland, first time ever out of North Carolina, and Virginia won that year, and Wally received the Everett Case Reward as the most valuable player in the tournament. So his career at Virginia had a terrific ending, a very happy ending.
Went on to play in the NBA and manage as well.
Correct.
So there's a follow-up in the works?
I'm thinking about it, and I'm hedging because I'm still trying to rest on my laurels, such as they are on this one, and I'm not sure if I want to do the same thing or if I'd like to do something different. I'm now retired, and I want to do books that are fun for me, and the next 20 years of the ACC would provide a fascinating topic in terms of great players, great coaches, great teams, great success in the NCAA. What I'm not what I'm not so sure about is whether the off-court issues are as interesting as they were in the period that my book covers. So I need to do some research. I need to make some decisions.
Well, lest anyone tuning in right now confuse you with a sports reporter, I should say that before this, your titles include Prompt and Utter Destruction, Truman and the Use of Atomic Bombs Against Japan, and The Road to Yucca Mountain, The Development of Radioactive Waste Policy in the United States. So
correct.
What? Well, that's a far cry from the ACC. Why did you turn your attention from those subjects?
Well, I spent my career, my job for most of my career as a professional historian was historian of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and in that capacity I wrote five books on nuclear power regulation. And in my off hours, I also wrote a book on Truman and the atomic bomb, and they were good subjects. I enjoyed it. But when I started thinking about retirement, I thought I wanted to do something different, and I kind of shopped around in my own mind for a good topic, and one day came up with the idea of doing a book on the early history of ACC basketball, and I thought to myself, well, is that a viable topic for a historian? I've always done massive research in records and papers and primary sources, and would there be primary sources on such a topic? And I went to the archives at the University of Maryland, which is very near my home, and found that they were just wonderful materials, minutes of meetings and correspondence, and just wonderful materials. So at that point then, I decided this is a viable topic, and it seemed like a fun topic that also covered some very important issues, which we've been talking about.
Yeah, I've only got about 30 seconds left, but you make no secret of the fact that you are a passionate fan of ACC basketball. Was it different for you as a professional historian to research a topic that you felt so passionate? I mean, you might be a passionate fan of nuclear power, I don't know, but but was it a kind
it's
of different?
Not the same.
Was it a different endeavor for you?
It wasn't, and I think my training as a historian served me well, and there's a lot to be admired about every ACC school, and certainly I have teams that I cheer for passionately now, but what I found is that I really learned a lot about the histories of every school as a member of the conference, and came to admire them. So I'm hoping that my history is balanced and nonpartisan.
It's a great book. Sam, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
J. Samuel Walker is the author of ACC Basketball, The Story of Rivalries, Traditions, and Scandals of the First Two Decades of the Atlantic Coast Conference. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Robin Copley is our technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.